Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Frenzer Foreman Animation Forum.
Yes.
How are you? I'm clapping with my hands behind my back.
I know. You're so flexible.
Now, when we last left off,
yeah,
you, Alan, stormed out of the studio. Never to be seen again.
Yeah.
And that brings us to right now.
Does it?
Yes.
This is quite a while after.
It is quite a while after. Many things have happened.
Yeah.
What happened from the point where you stormed off until right now?
God, so many things. I mean, we spent a whole week in Los Angeles together interviewing people. Then I came back home to New York, and you stayed out in Los Angeles.
Yeah, parties.
And then I've just been working.
You have been very busy.
Yes.
So, I think,
should I make this announcement?
That announcement?
Yeah.
On air live now?
Should I?
Yeah.
I came back to New York, and I started my own company.
Oh, boys!
My own animation production company.
What's it called?
Model A Productions.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. Oh,
look at that. Oh, my hands started clapping before my brain was making them.
Yeah, yeah.
That's big news.
It's huge for me to, you know, this is a whole new step, new chapter in my life. It's a new thing I wanted to try, and I'm just going to give it a go, see what happens.
Alan is a busy, busy animation machine right now.
Yeah.
But don't fear, because we're going to continue our interviews from L.A.,
Yep, we have them all recorded. We have them all recorded, so we're going to be just playing the interviews over the course of the next few episodes.
We're going to go back. Sam Olshan will be there. Computer will be there. Speaking of computer, he's going to help us do this. He's going to be our conduit for continuity by helping us go back to that time. And we're going to go back now to an interview we did in July with Janie Geiser. Computer, summon us all back through time and space and space time. Here we go. Computer, summon Janie Geiser. Here she is. She's coming in.
Oh, hi,
welcome.
Guys. Hi.
Welcome. Hi. You sat down very fast. Yeah. That was good.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm fast.
Yeah. So, welcome to our Los Angeles taping. How are you?
I'm good. It's summer. I like summer.
Yeah, it's bright.
It's very bright here. You have to, someone like me, I avoid the brightness during the day.
How do you avoid?
I hug the shadows.
Me too. I found that every time I come to LA, no matter what I do to prevent it, I think the sunlight actually will bend around whatever I have and go into my cornea just because it wants to hurt me.
Sunglasses are important.
Yeah.
I double up. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that, I mean, look, I have old man sunglasses that go over my regular glasses with like the side thing. Right. And still it goes.
Blue blockers.
Blue. Right?
They're a little bit Spock-like or something.
Yeah. Are they?
Like, or Star Trek-like or something.
Is that at all intimidating?
No,
it's fine. But we don't have the sun in here anyway.
I just want to be intimidating, but whatever.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm scared.
Thank you. Ooh. Oh, I never get that from anyone. Ooh. Oh, good. Good. So, you are an animator.
I guess.
Comma, performer, comma, video installation artist, comma, video artist, comma, filmmaker, comma, puppet creator, found objects.
Manipulator.
Manipulator. Mm-hmm. Are all of those things true?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, they are true. I usually just say I'm an artist.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Kind of a much simpler way.
But
to put
it, you know, it's good to have some descriptive things there.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Good. Now, you have made several films that are films that you would see in a theater on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You've made several things that are installations in galleries.
Mm-hmm.
What have you found to be the benefits to expression, creative expression, in both of those? And are they different?
They are different. In galleries, basically, people don't deal with the normal duration of an object, you know, of a film object.
Mm-hmm.
They come in when they want to, and they leave when they want to. And I did a piece that was a 6-minute loop, and inevitably people would leave, you know, 5.5 minutes into it or not come in when it started. And so that can be frustrating. So making something that actually can work with those parameters is a goal. And then, of course, having something that's shown more formally in a theater or in a gallery as a film, then people come in, sit down, watch it, and then leave. So it's kind of nice. They get to see it exactly how you intended mm-hmm. it, if the projection is good.
Is your process for making work different for each because you have to consider the audience in a different way?
A little bit, but I think it's more that each idea finds its own form. So one idea might really be an installation idea mm-hmm. and not something that would work in a film that has a specific duration for sitting down.
Because we've talked a lot about mm-hmm. considering the audience. It's mm-hmm. one of his favorite subjects.
Mm-hmm.
One of my least favorite subjects mm-hmm. because it's so confusing.
Hmm. Right. And I think, how do you consider the audience when you don't know who is going to sit down
mm-hmm.
or who is going to be standing up? So you really have to make work that, in a selfish way, pleases yourself first. Mm-hmm. And if you're happy with it, then showing it in the context that you intended is probably going to be somewhat satisfying too.
Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we should back up a little bit.
Okay.
Let's roll the clock back.
Let's just go back a little bit. Can you tell us how you got started as an artist?
Okay.
And what influences you?
Well, I got started. I was one of those people who, you know, in high school, I had a secret desire to be an artist, but I was a, you know, good academic kid. And I went to a school where they made me take all like AP classes and stuff. And so when I was a senior in high school, I said, well, I really want to take an art class. And they were like, oh, but seniors can't take Art 1. And then they also said, and besides, art is for the dumb kids.
What?
They basically really
said that? Where was this?
Well, I'm not going to name the school, but they know who they are.
What state?
Georgia. Catholic school.
Where in Georgia?
And, you know, so I the class I could take to rebel was typing.
Wow.
Just because I thought, okay, I'm not going to take calculus. I'm going to take something that I can kind of chill on. But they wouldn't let me take art. So then when mm-hmm. I started college, I went to University of Georgia. And this is the advantage of going to a big school where you're anonymous. You have to declare a major. So I was a French major. But my second quarter there, I said, oh, I want to take an art class. And they're like, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, so I didn't need a portfolio, which was good because I didn't have one. And so I took this class, and it was taught by an abstract expressionist painter. And it was called Art in the Dark. And what we did, it was very exciting for this little, you know, academically trained kid to, he would flash up slides of things like Franz Kline paintings.
Right.
And then we had 6 seconds to get the gesture on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, hey, this is great. I really like this. And then over the course of the class, we moved into actually drawing objects and, you know, rendering things. And then I was like, this is it. I'm going to take art. And so that's when it started, and I think because I was so far behind, I hadn't been the kid that was always drawing, I worked really hard, and by the end, I felt like I caught up, and by the time I was out of school, I just wanted to draw and paint.
So this happened
in high school. We won't go with the dates, but yeah. this was in college.
Okay. In college.
Yeah.
Okay. But you weren't a doodler.
I was
school.
A doodle.
You
know, I always drew in the margins of my books, but I didn't take
home,
that
you
seriously.
Didn't draw a lot as a
at
kid?
At home, or? No. Well, I came from a really big family,
yeah.
And there really weren't even places you could sit down and leave a notebook.
Yeah.
So it was just more active than that
at
home. So I, you know, every once in a while I would draw something, but also I was worried about the ridicule of my siblings, so I would kind of hide it. I'm revealing a lot about myself here. So it was a big deal to actually take art, say, okay, this is what I want to do. And when I told my parents, I went home that summer and was like, well, you know, I kind of want to switch to be an art major. And my mom was so happy. And it was because when she was going to go to college, she wanted to study art. But it was right after World War II. And she had to be practical.
Mm-hmm.
So she really thought it was great. And my dad was, whatever you want to do that makes you happy. So that was over.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they had to just deal with the fact that I was going to be a waitress a lot, which is what I did. I think my first 5 years out of college, I didn't go to grad school. I just wanted to do it. You know, in my first 5 years out of college, I would waitress two nights a week and then just draw the rest of the time.
Wow. Where did you go right after?
I was in Atlanta, which I was always itching to get out of. But yeah, things kept happening that kept me there longer than I thought I should stay. Which the first one was I met somebody bought one of my drawings and I needed to photograph it. So I called them and said, can I get it back to photograph it? And then it turned out this was somebody who was really involved with this nonprofit artist run gallery that was just starting up there. And he said, we've got these government jobs for positions there, and would you like a job? And I was like, oh, okay. What is it, secretary? I said, I don't have any secretarial skills. And he said, that doesn't
matter.
Wait,
didn't you take typing?
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
There you go.
But, you know, my family moved in the middle of my senior year, so I only had half a year of typing. I could never incorporate the numbers into the letters. But so I got a job, which turned into actually kind of running a gallery, a nonprofit, very funky, you know, artist run space, and met all these artists and dancers and photographers because it had all these different kinds of art forms all under one roof. And that was really formative for me, too. So around that time, I started making 3D things that had objects that were kind of like puppets in them. And dioramas, very, I would say, influenced by someone, although I didn't know it at the time, Joseph Cornell. I started doing it, and people told me about Joseph Cornell, and then I looked at his work, and I'm like, wow, this guy, he's great. So I started incorporating puppets, and then somebody said, well, you know, there's a puppetry center here in Atlanta. So I checked that out, and it was a place that was, they had started as a children's puppet theater, but then they decided, I mean, the guy who ran it was really interested in adult puppet theater. And so he saw what I was doing and, like, invited me over there. And he said, do you want a job? So I got a job, like, organizing their collection of old puppets.
What kind of puppets were they?
Yeah. Oh, they were, like, old Punch and Judy puppets and vaudeville puppets and, you know, puppets from all around the world and Indonesian shadow puppets. So I would just be in this little area under the seating of the theater, which was the gallery, kind of like the lobby, and I would just take the puppets and look at how they were made. And, you know, that was kind of my puppet lesson place in the dark under these seats. So then I started doing more incorporating puppets. And then he said, I mean, people were always suggesting things to me that, oh, okay. He said, well, you should make a show. And, you know, I didn't come from theater, but at this nonprofit art center, I had also been designing things for some of the theater and dance people. So I was getting around performance and even taking dance classes. So then I just was naive enough to go, okay, I'll make a puppet show. And so then I did that, and then I fell in love with that because it's such an amazing art form and people don't really think about it much, but it is
and
so powerful.
How so, from a performer's perspective?
Well, I think, you know, well, puppets, when you go to theater and you see people doing theater, I mean, this is not to denigrate any person that does theater, but you see that specific person. And as much as you see the character that they're portraying, you also see, okay, they're this tall, they're, you know, their skin is spotted, or they're, you know, whatever about them. And you see all of their extra moves that they make that aren't their planned moves. And with a puppet, you see exactly what the artist intends you to see, although, of course, you're adding to that. So people always talk about the puppet as a blank vessel on which the audience projects as much as the artist does. And so, and you also have to think about every movement of the puppet being very deliberate. And, of course, you have extra movement in there because it's operated by a puppeteer. And also the puppet, how it's constructed affects how it's moving too. So you might be working against some resistance, or the arm joint is loose that day. So, you know, there's a lot of variables there too. But it's, there's something about being able to really construct a whole world and construct the characters in that world that allows you to a certain kind of storytelling. As I started doing the puppetry, I also was really interested in animation. And I sat in on a class at in a school in Atlanta. And then I saw, oh my God, that's a whole other can of worms. And I decided to get better at the theater before I started the animation. So it was always in the back of my mind that that would add in later. So I think doing animation, it's a different kind of control that you have between live and animated. And with an animated film, first of all, I can work by myself, which is a great balance to working with a lot of people doing theater. And you can just meditate. It's like painting for me. That's a meditative space and a very free space. And I feel, for some reason, less compelled to tell direct stories with animation. It's more of a collage form for me, the way that I've been working. Whereas in theater, I think, again, thinking about the audience, but thinking about myself going to theater too, there's some way you want to wrap it up for the audience, even if you're leaving it open-ended. And so it demands a little bit more narrative, I think.
Right.
And I don't always think in narrative, so the animation, the film work allows me that part of my brain, the kind of painter side, to have free rein. And then with the theater, I do have a storytelling side too. So it's that is kind of best met there. And then I do love that interaction with a live audience that you have in theater. And the way that it changes every time you show it.
It's more interaction.
Yeah, it's a very interactive form. All this stuff about interactive digital media. Live theater is so interactive.
It's so great to hear you say all this, because my whole path of why I'm even here today also comes from puppets.
Oh, well, tell me about that.
Shall I?
Yes, please.
All right.
You said I could ask questions.
Okay, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Joel, tell me about that.
Okay. There I was on the plains of Nebraska, innocent, wide-eyed, looking at the world.
Husking some corn.
Husking corn, detasseling corn.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Crossbreeding. Serious
work. For a 13-year-old child labor. it was against the law. But I did it anyway. I was an illustrator, made comics. Before going to Rhode Island School of Design, I was at Washington University in St. Louis.
That's a great school.
Great school. I had a great time. I did a comic strip in the paper there, weekly comic strip. And I didn't know, getting back to audience, if anyone was reading it. I saw it there.
And they kept wanting it to be in there.
Printing it. I don't know if they wanted it, but they kept printing it. And at a certain point, I was asking people, so what do you think of it? I started getting some responses, and it just wasn't satisfying. I mean, they liked it, but something was missing. So then I decided, after taking a bunch of classes, 3D classes and whatnot, I'm going to change this from a comic strip into a live puppet show.
But why did you even think of puppets?
I had this inexplicable need to perform.
Okay.
And I wasn't getting that by being a lone cartoonist in my room.
Mm-hmm. But why didn't you just do it without the puppets? Like, just perform it?
Because I, at that time, well, huge fan of The Muppet Show, always was, from the beginning of The Muppet Show. And I saw a PBS Great Performances special on Jim Henson around this exact same time. And I started seeing a lot of similarities between what he was tackling and all of that. And I said, you know what? I'm going to try to do this. I'm just going to see if I can take something that's 2D and make it 3D. Just that was a basic thing I was working at the time. So I took my characters and made them into these puppets. I started to gather interest from other students around, and we formed this improv puppet troupe and performed all around campus.
That's so exciting.
It was a lot of fun, and I was getting that immediate response from the audience. Like you were saying, I was changing what I was doing based on what they were saying or how they were reacting. And these shows were really fun and lively, and it was kind of, this was way before Avenue Q. Right, we were doing adult puppet, Muppet stuff. Even before I saw Meet the Feebles, which when I saw that, I was really excited. But
that movie's changed my life.
So,
yeah.
You loved it, didn't you?
No, I think I missed that one.
Okay. You would love it.
Okay.
No, you'd hate it. So then I was now performing in front of people. It was great. Except, here's the thing. We had a stage. I was crouched down low. These are hand puppets. Mm-hmm. And I was doing this all the time.
Right.
I couldn't see the audience. It was also very difficult to consistently put on these shows, though fun. So then I went all the way around and I said, well, what if I animated them and had that control and then played it in front of an audience to see what that was like?
Mm-hmm.
It took about another year and kind of molded them off of that and into cutout pieces. And I had no idea what I was doing. There's no animation class there. I shot on Super 8 and made my first animated film, played it at a student festival, and now I was at the back of the theater hearing the reaction and seeing the people, though their heads from the back of the theater, watching it, and it was already done. I didn't have to think about the live performance.
Right.
And that was really satisfying. And I actually then transferred to RISD and continued doing that there. But also, when I was there, because I know this is your next question, I continued working with live puppetry and worked with Big Nozzo.
Oh, yeah. I know them.
Erminio?
Erminio. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great guy.
He's a great guy. Yeah. I learned a ton there and went much further in how to construct puppets and make puppets. And these were big costume puppets and performed big in front of people and went on these tours. And it was fantastic.
And a lot of it is out in the streets as well.
Out in the streets. Yeah. So really perfected improv there, especially where you're in an oven, basically. These things are not air conditioned.
Those suits, yeah.
Yeah. Just, you know, layers and layers of foam. It gave me a lot of confidence. Then I also did animation alongside that.
Well, they really go together well. It's like a circle that you can keep going one direction on or the other.
Which is why when they refer to, you know, stop motion puppets, they say they're stop motion puppets.
Right.
They're not stop motion something else. They're
dolls. Still
dolls. You could say that. So anyway, that's me. Do you want to hear more about me?
I actually have a strange question about puppets.
Yeah.
Especially for you guys. Okay. The experience, among many questions, experience of when you do spend so much time making this puppet and animating this puppet, aside from what the actual piece is about, the emotional connection that the builder performer has with the object, the experience you have while manipulating it, or, you know, just elaborate on that, I guess.
I think it moves back and forth between, like, this is just sticks. These are sticks that are put together, or fabric or wood. And then in the process of performing it or working on a film with a puppet, it does kind of create its own character that's separate from you, I think, partly through what the puppet looks like, how you're performing it or how someone else is performing it. And it does take on a certain life, but in a sense, I know it's not the same as a real person. And so when it breaks, it's more like, okay, you have to get fixed. You know, I don't really get upset about that. In theatrical pieces, we always keep a glue gun in the corner, and every puppeteer has a piece of gaff tape on their pants or on their shirt so that you can just pull it instantly and tape something together. And basically any thing can be fixed temporarily that way.
Sounds like my apartment.
Sounds like my life. Yeah. Gaff tape is important.
Yeah,
good stuff.
Yeah.
Continuing on, so now you're moving into, you made a puppet show. And how was that reaction?
My first puppet show was, I would say, one of the most satisfying experiences artistically in my life. And not that life hasn't been good after that, but you know, when you first encounter something and you imagine it and it turns out pretty close to what you imagined without being proscribed. Yeah, it was really satisfying.
And were these hand puppets?
It was a combination of hand puppets and rod puppets operated from below. And flat rod puppets as well. So, and I worked with, there were four puppeteers in the show, including myself. The first time I did it, I did the voice for the main puppet, but I found it was really hard to do that and direct the piece. Because my brain would be focused on the whole, and then I was having to do the separate part. Now, somebody who's really an actor, performer, that's not such a split for them. But after that, I got narrators or actors to do the voices, and that was much better for me, my own particular process. But I love performing. I do less of it now because I end up wanting to stand back and look at the whole thing and put it together. But whenever I do perform, and in some smaller pieces I usually do, it's very satisfying. It's a really fun way to perform. Yeah.
How did that then move into combining with your fine arts life?
When I was made my first puppet show, the people in my fine arts life, some of them really were excited, and some of them said, "But what are you doing? Are you going to abandon that world?" You know, and slowly I did, because I was much more compelled to make time-based work, and that's what I discovered through this. And I had been doing some dioramas that had motors in them, or going back to the question about installation, things that were kind of loops, which I liked as well. But I really loved the time-based quality of the theater, and then that's what also led me to animation. So, people got used to it after a while. Because also, now puppet theater's cool now. Right. But puppet theater was not cool in the 80s. or for a very small group of people, it was cool. So it's like the line in Being John Malkovich, if you remember, right, where Catherine Keener says to John Cusack, "Well, what do you do?"
I'm
a puppeteer.
Yeah.
Check, please. Yeah. So that's kind of how it felt. Or I was always explaining myself, no, I'm not making children's theater.
Right.
So that was hard because, you know, when you're an artist, a fine artist, you're fine. You know, people think you're an adult, you know, and doing adult things. And when you say, well, I'm doing puppetry, there really was this attitude of condensation toward it, you know. But and so, you know, I tried the calling it always performing objects or things like that, but you know, they're puppets and they're great, and I love the form. Yeah.
Computer has a question.
Oh, computer, go ahead.
Okay. Oh, computer wants to know. He's a little shy. Oh,
okay.
A little shy. I translate. If you ever had favorite animations as a child, or if you ever experienced puppet as a child, puppet animation, puppet theater from the past, and also what you're interested in now in the future, or present and future.
I guess as a kid, I mean, my one live puppet thing that I remembered was at like a swim party where somebody got a puppet act, and it was frogs playing guitars, and I thought it was so dumb. So that was like my one live puppet experience. So it didn't make me go, oh, I want to do puppets. And I grew up kind of in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I didn't ever go to an art gallery, except like a historical kind of art gallery. And in high school in Atlanta, finally, I went to an art museum. Actually, the weirdest art experience that I have, in a sense, is that I grew up Catholic. And in the, you know, what they call the missal, which is the prayer book that you have at Mass, there are lots of great Raphaels and Michelangelos, like these religious paintings. Yeah. And so as a kid, I basically thought these were illustrations for this book. And then later, I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God. These are famous paintings. You know? And of course, I knew about the Mona Lisa and those kind of things. But it was really, you know, so all of that was pretty new to me. I saw some things that later I realized were like Yuri Trinka, people like that, that happened to be on TV. So those things. But I don't know. You know, Susan Pitt. You know, I saw her before I started making films, and I was like, oh my God. So I think that was, and I've told her this, you know, that was a really inspirational film for me, Asparagus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it was something that unfolded in a less narrative kind of time, and one idea just led to another without the kind of logic that one would think it would have to have. So that was really inspiring. Plus, it was so beautifully painted.
And
And that shot at the end with all of those stop motion puppets.
Theater shot. Really, really fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, someone sits on a toilet and asparagus comes out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so it was like a kind of, you know, scatological taboo that was so beautifully done, you know, that nobody was getting upset.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's so artful, that film, and all of her
it's
work.
It's mesmerizing,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
The pace of it. So, Automata.
Mm-hmm.
When was that formed?
2004, with my friend Susan Simpson, who actually does animation and puppet theater as well.
Mm-hmm.
She studied at Brown and then at CalArts. So, the first year I got there, she was just finishing up, and we found a lot of common interests. And so we started this organization partly because, you know, coming from New York, where there's such a great puppet community, we wanted to make our own here and find a place. It's good when you have a place or an idea that forms a center for people to gravitate toward. So we decided to start this little nonprofit. And we've gone through different iterations. Right now we're really looking for a space. And actually have all next year planned out in case we find a space. and our mission is on the creation, presentation, and something else, produce puppet theater, experimental film, and all kinds of lost and neglected art forms.
Mm.
Mm. So it's pretty wide what we want to do, but always kind of coming back to the constructed image, in a sense, like whether it's animated, in an installation, performed. And there's quite a nice community here of people doing, you know, puppet theater, object performance, installation, and of course animation and film, experimental film. So we've been really happy about what we've been doing.
It'd be a space to create and perform?
Yeah, we want to have a theater space, like a maybe 70-seat theater, and then also maybe some flexible space where you could have 20 people watch something, maybe have an exhibit, show films in either space, and definitely a storefront window where things could happen.
One of your pieces that was really captivating was your installation, The Spider's Wheel.
Mm-hmm.
You can describe it a little bit more, but what I like about it is you're kind of making a puppet out of the screen.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to describe a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's sort of hard to describe, but basically about a 5 foot long by 1 foot deep by 3 feet high plexiglass box. That's made from strips of plexiglass that are actually stitched together. And so that's hanging in a room over a green plexiglass floor. But on top of the box are two hinged doors and on two sides, and they are perforated metal. So from different sides of the room, that box is projected onto, but it's also mechanical. So a woman that was a found image from an old film, is crawling through a tunnel, but now it looks like she's crawling around the box. And she keeps crawling around the box and really not getting anywhere. And at one point, the metal flaps rise, and she's still projected onto the plexiglass now. And then you sort of forget that the metal flaps have risen, and 30 seconds later, they slam back down. Mm. So part of what I was looking at there was sort of the history of women superheroes and women heroines in early film. They were always, you know, they were heroines, but they were also limits to what they were allowed to do a sense. Like there was often a man that would come in right at the moment where the woman is doing the rescue and kind of clean it up or, you know, add to the rescue. So part of what I was just playing around with was just this idea of those kind of limits to that superhero-ness.
Here's a question.
Yeah.
Lillian Gish or Lady Gaga, who ripped off Madonna more?
Well, you have to look at chronologically who ripped off who.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Were the images projected to scale?
What do you mean?
The silent era heroines, was that to scale, human body scale, on the box?
I didn't even think about that, but it's about human scale, I would think.
That was one thing from seeing it, a videotape of it.
Was pretty much human scale. And what I did, too, because I wanted the woman to go through a little bit of a transformation. So she's crawling around the box, and that's from The Perils of Pauline. but collage, different usage, it should be okay rights-wise. But then I wanted her to get in more trouble than just crawling through this box, so I filmed an actress doing similar things, and her clothes are getting ripped as she goes through it, so she gets a little bit more and more in trouble, which might be hard to see on a video of it. But
and the screen itself is woven together.
Yeah. So there's sewing, stitchery, those mm-hmm. kind of things being, quote, you know, women's
right.
work.
Right.
I wanted to have some of that. But plus to give the screen some texture was really fun and make it very constructed looking, not like a piece of found flat plexiglass. Because the plexi was sanded to accept the image, too.
Right.
So she just, as she crawls, she gets more and more worn out, and her clothes are more worn out, and she loses her shoes. And then there's a kind of fire image that's superimposed, and then it starts over.
Is that a kind of piece, then, that can tour around galleries?
Yeah, although it's right in my garage right now.
That's kind of a gallery.
Yeah, well, that's...
It's a personal.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to see things in that gallery.
Yeah.
And now your short films mm-hmm. are much more collaged,
mm-hmm.
Puppet projections. Maybe just describe a little bit of kind of how that evolved
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. and maybe up to what you might be working on now.
Okay. Well, my first films that I made as parts of performances. So I make a little section. And they were not animated, but they might kind of like what you were describing, filmed live. Puppets mm-hmm. and then edited Super 8. And then I made one almost standalone film in a kind of installation performance that I did. And then I kind of like these standalone things. So that was made with puppets and sets and shot live. But I was a little frustrated because on film, sometimes those puppet movements look kind of awkward and jerky. Mm-hmm. You have to, mm-hmm. it's very hard to control it for the live camera. So I thought, well, next time I'm going to animate it. And I used cutouts, painted mm-hmm. cutouts for that one called the Red Book. Mm-hmm. And so that was really satisfying. The first role that I shot, everything was too fast. So I had to kind of learn on the job, and I threw out most of that role, but then I started to get control. And then after that film, I used a few painted elements and mostly collage elements. I think partly just, again, this thing I was talking about, I didn't want everything to look exactly alike, and I do have a certain kind of painting illustration style, and I wanted to push beyond that. So I started bringing in the collage elements, and then I just loved that because mm-hmm. partly I could really make films without planning them. and for me, I love improvisation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And to be able to just start gathering things and then shooting a little bit, looking at that, gathering more things, and you know, having a sense in my mind of what the emotional terrain of the film was or what the visual terrain was, and then really letting the film kind of take its own course.
I have a two-part question.
Okay, go for it.
Your work is more avant-garde experimental.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you screen it? And then how do you gain funding to fuel your art?
To make it. Well, you know, there's fewer and fewer sources, so we'll get to that second. There are a lot of film festivals, and, you know, the New York Film Festival has the views from the avant-garde, and kind of from that, although San Francisco always had some experimental film shows too, but a lot of the festivals now have a kind of experimental section,
mm-hmm.
and Rotterdam, of course, has always had that, mm-hmm. and a lot of European festivals. I've had much less luck with animation festivals
mm-hmm.
than I have with avant-garde or general international film festivals.
Mm.
And then, you know, museums often have experimental film screenings, and colleges,
mm-hmm.
you know, they have some of the best film screenings, you know, like think about University of Wisconsin, Chicago
right.
Art Institute has that great series at what's the name of that theater?
Conversations at the Edge,
uh-huh.
At the Gene Siskel.
Yeah, the Gene Siskel Theater, and that's a great theater to show at. So, you know, that's another circuit that all the experimental filmmakers, you know, travel through, and I think the animation people who define themselves more right. in terms of animation. I would say I define myself more in the experimental film world, mm-hmm. partly because of the kind of form mm-hmm. that I'm using.
The other part of that question, mm-hmm. the funding.
Oh, the funding. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Right, well,
let's get to the meat.
California has some of the worst state funding in the sense that there aren't state grants for artists.
There's no money in the state.
The city of Los Angeles Department of Cultural Affairs is a holy agency in that they really fight to maintain funding for artists against all odds, and I really applaud them. And we have a 2-year small organizational grant from for Automata through them, and they've been funding cultural exchanges by partnering with people like the Fund for Mutual Understanding. So actually Susan Simpson and I and Chris Bereka, who teaches design at CalArts, we're going to Russia in the fall to work with a theater company there, and that's through them. So the city really tries to keep it going. And then there's the LA County Arts. And then there are some good private foundations here that aren't somewhere else, like the Durfee Foundation, which offers, I feel like I'm an ad for but it's great because they're in a climate where it's not so popular to fund the arts, and you're not doing like what looks like a socially good thing. You're not feeding anyone except artists, which we need to be fed.
Don't we
as
need
well.
To be fed?
Yeah. But the Durfee Foundation is great. They do finishing funds, small grants, and so artists who say have an opportunity to show somewhere but can't make a print,
right?
You know,
right.
And then there's this great, you know, fairly new organization called Center for Cultural Innovation. And they have grants for artists that are about making long-term conditions for your work better. So you can apply, say, to fix up your studio or buy a certain tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I suggested to them in a grant application that I needed more studio space in my driveway and was awarded funding for a trailer. Wow. Which is my studio now.
Oh, that's it's fantastic.
Incredible. It's, yeah. It has really changed my that's ability
a great
to work.
Idea.
And yeah. You can take it anywhere?
You can take your
no,
studio.
It's actually kind of an old, it's I went for beauty over practicality. Okay. Yeah, yeah. It's a 1955, like, Airstream? It's not an Airstream, it's a competitor, not. The nice. Airfloat.
Airfloat, yeah.
It's called the Land Yacht.
Those are beautiful. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And it has round windows
to wear,
like a boat.
White sole shoes when you enter.
No, no. It's actually much more funky than that. But you know, it's so there are some good places, but it's very difficult for an artist to only depend on grants. I mean, there were times when you could, you know. Then there's national things like the Guggenheim you can get once in your life, or Creative Capital, which you can get once in every 10 years.
And you receive some of
those. I've received some of those. I'm finally able to get a Creative Capital again if I apply and get one.
All right.
So I'm happy about that.
Where can people see your work?
Well, at least one of the new films called Ghost Algebra is going to be in the Views from the Avant-Garde in the New York Film Festival. Oh. And possibly a second film. I'm waiting to hear about that. In LA, I'm going to do a show sometime this fall. I'm actually doing something at USC in October, but I think another show when I get this third film finished, I'll show them all together. And at Automata, we're working on our website, but eventually you can go to automatala.com and see what's going on there, or janiegeiser.com.
And are you sure it's not pronounced automata, which is what I said?
I'm sure. Actually, when we first started it, we said automata, and then the great film scholar Tom Gunning corrected me.
Oh, boy.
and he's the one who wrote about the cinema of attractions, which is part of what we were talking about. Yeah. So I believed him because he knows all pre-cinema better than anybody. So it's like, okay, it's automata. Now I'm used to saying it. I had to correct my own self for years.
It's kind of more Italian to say automata.
Yeah,
automata.
You can say it any way you want. We don't really worry about it.
Well, it has been a pleasure having you here
talking about what you just said.
Yeah, well, it's great to talk to you guys, too. It's a really nice conversation.
And you're welcome back anytime.
Okay.
And Janie Geyser, everyone, thank you.
Thank you very much for coming.
Computer will escort you out. Oh, look at that. They're arm in arm. Oh, that's nice. Oh, that's so sweet. And we're back.
Yeah.
Back to the present.
Back to Brooklyn.
Alan, hold up a newspaper, today's paper, so that people know it is present day. There's one right there. He's holding it up. Proof positive. Exactly today.
Can you read it?
Yeah. It says it's today.
Good.
Alan?
Yeah.
Good luck with all the work you have. This is great.
Thanks. Yeah. No. Well, it's going to be as soon as we're done recording this, I'm going right back to work.
Literally. You're going to go right through the night and work to your heart's content.
That's right. Well, I don't know about that, but yeah, something like that.
Your abilities content.
Yes. There you go.
Everybody, we will see you next week.
Right, bye-bye.
Enjoy your week.
Yeah.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.